Many friends have asked me to explain why I believe in rebirth. For some reason, it occurred to me when I was only 5 or 6 years old to contemplate, with the slender resources available at that time, the nature of my own existence. It seemed perfectly natural to assume that I had always existed. No one suggested this to me, nor would family discussion have been of any help. It was simply an insistent conviction that I had lived before, somewhere, sometime. My efforts to explore this problem were not especially successful, because consciousness seemed to disappear in an infancy that was dark and silent. Self-consciousness, however, did not seem to be a beginning, but an awakening out of sleep. It seemed to fulfill an expectation, like a person who, retiring for the night, was resolved to awaken at a certain time. It was difficult to figure out why I had awakened when I did, and in the particular environment which surrounded me. My feelings can be summed up as a simple predisposition to accept rebirth as an obvious and inescapable fact, so real and certain that it required neither proof nor defense. As time passed, I learned that the doctrine of rebirth is not a minority belief held only by a small group of eccentric individuals. Actually, it is one of the oldest and most universally distributed of all concepts bearing upon the total existence of man. It is held in common by members of every race and all levels of culture, from the savage to the sage. There is no reason to apologize because we are interested in a doctrine that has flourished for thousands of years, was publicly taught by Gautama Buddha, and stoutly defended by Pythagoras, Socrates, and Plato. Nor is it an old belief long outgrown, for in this time, our 20th century, nearly one half the population of the world accepts the law of rebirth in some form or to some degree, and this number is constantly increasing. Such statistics in no way prove rebirth to be true, but they do indicate that it is a major religious and philosophical conviction, entitled to as much consideration and respect as any other teaching relating to the origin and destiny of man. In this little talk, we shall devote no further time to the weighing of historical evidence, or an attempt to prove our point by reference to tradition or authority. My own beliefs are not based upon the fashions of any age, the opinions of the learned, or the teachings of the venerated. I would hold it a sacred right to agree or disagree with anyone, past or present. To me, the only valid foundation for conviction is such personal insight as I may possess, and such experience as has arisen, by which this insight is tested through applications. We must all believe in something, and even unbelief is only a negative kind of believing. Unfortunately, there is no way to prove spiritual truths to universal satisfaction. If then, for my own well-being, I must build my internal life upon some concept, I can choose such a concept as seems most suitable to my requirements, best calculated to contribute to a full and useful life, and in closest conformity with my highest ethical and moral convictions. The belief in rebirth has met this need in myself, and experience has shown me beyond doubt that it has helped countless persons to build a more gracious and intelligent way of life. At this point, it might be well to define our subject. The doctrine of rebirth affirms that man, as a rational being, is not identical with the body that he inhabits, that he has an eternal existence apart from body, and that in the course of personal growth, he is born many times into the physical world. This series of embodiments makes possible the unfoldment of human consciousness and the orderly release and development of the infinite potential locked within man. At any given time, therefore, man is the sum of his own past achievements. He must meet and face the present requirements of growth, and he is the architect of his own future. There can be nothing more useful or necessary to the individual than a basic philosophy for living. And codes of conduct are usually founded in religious convictions. Let us consider, then, our definition of rebirth in the light of those spiritual concepts which we have long held sacred. As a student of comparative religion, it seems to me that there are three essential doctrines which all enlightened religions hold in common. The first of these affirms that there is a supreme power or principle at the root of existence, which we usually call God, and that this absolute being, this source of life, is responsible for the unfoldment of creation. The law of rebirth assumes the reality of such a superior and infinite being, and demonstrates how this being attains its purposes in a lawful and understandable manner. The second essential doctrine of religion is the immortality of the human soul. This is the belief that man, transcending death, survives as a spiritual being, having an existence outside of and apart from the physical body in which he dwells during his material life. The superior and immortal part of man is more important than his body and should be given proper and due consideration. This implies that the attributes of the soul bearing upon character, morality, and ethics should be perpetually cultivated as indispensable to the growth and security of the immortal person within the mortal body. The law of rebirth affirms all this to be true. It points out, however, that the actual perfection of man cannot be accomplished in one lifetime, but is possible only through a succession of embodiments or incarnations. The third basic article of faith is the ultimate victory of good over evil. God, or the divine principle, is sovereign wisdom and supreme good, and all the works of deity must therefore be wisely and eternally benevolent. To compromise this conviction is to compromise God. But it is not always possible for man, with limited vision and understanding, to prove to his own internal satisfaction and contentment that the conditions through which he passes, with their uncertainties and tribulations, are in harmony with the will of an all-loving Creator. The law of rebirth gives the thoughtful person a larger perspective on life, provides him with better insight into the long-range workings of cause and effect, and thus strengthens his faith in both God and himself. Man may not see the beginnings or ends of the patterns affecting him, but sustained by the doctrine of rebirth, he can envision a sensible way of life in which all things work together for ultimate good. There is nothing in the doctrine of rebirth that conflicts with man's basic conclusions on the level of philosophy. On the side of practical living, rebirth strongly supports the highest ethical and moral precepts taught by enlightened philosophical systems. Nor does rebirth conflict with the abstract speculations of the learned, as these relate to the universal state of man. It seems to me that the conflict is simply between idealism and materialism. Idealistic philosophical systems either sustain rebirth or find it compatible. Materialistic thinkers just ignore rebirth, but have no comprehensive concept to offer in its place. Rebirth cannot be incompatible with science, as now defined, because it deals with a level of ideas essentially outside the province of science, and about which science has advanced no certain or conclusive evidence. Psychology, an art which is assuming scientific status, has taken the attitude that the mystery of man's inner life is solvable, and is gradually but surely differentiating between the person and the body which he inhabits. In view of these present trends, it is quite possible that the next important scientific discovery will bear upon the continuity of consciousness after death and apart from the physical organism. Certainly, evidence is accumulating, which sustains rather than refutes the teachings of rebirth. To me, therefore, this doctrine is especially valuable because it does not force me to accept anything that appears unreasonable in any branch of learning, nor does it require that I reject the advantages of knowledge or the benefits of progress in religion, philosophy, or science. It places no arbitrary limitations upon the future unfoldment of learning, for it encourages advancement in every field. It is suitable to all degrees of scholarship, being as useful and inspiring to the uneducated as to the educated. Unlike many popular concepts, it cannot be quickly outgrown or come into conflict with new discoveries. Rather, it encourages reflection and rescues my thinking from the conflicts of dogmas and the clash of creeds. Years of intimate contact with persons and their problems have convinced me that we all share in common doubts, fears, and uncertainties, and that these negative pressures frequently lead to a general attitude of futility. Troubled human beings are often impelled to ask, why are we here? Why should we suffer? And why should we have faith in anything? It seems to me that the law of rebirth, with its simple, positive statement of man's essential purpose, is the only doctrine that answers all such questions reasonably and adequately. According to the teaching of rebirth, we are all here to grow and to learn. Self-improvement is possible to everyone, and if we build our philosophy of life around the willingness to grow cheerfully and wisely, we resolve most of our doubts concerning providence. We are not here merely to succeed on the physical plane. We are here to succeed totally, which means that we must improve as persons, seeking richer internal values, deeper understanding, and a better orientation to the universal plan. By this concept, daily experience becomes a constant invitation to learning, as this relates to self-knowledge and to the knowledge of all other things. The whole world is, then, like the traditional little red schoolhouse, and we are all students, willing or unwilling, learning our ABCs in the University of Life. In the material world, education is recognized as a progressive procedure. The student graduates only after he has successfully advanced his various studies, passed his examinations, and proved his proficiency. By this process, it requires nearly 20 years to prepare the average child for a trade or profession, and much of his nature has remained uncultivated. It is also obvious that his internal life has been almost totally neglected. Accepting these evident facts, is it conceivable that man can attain complete spiritual maturity as a citizen of the universe in any single lifetime, regardless of ability or sincerity? Man is eternal. Learning is eternal. And the doctrine of rebirth provides the individual with conditions favorable for the final attainment of true wisdom and understanding. According to this doctrine, immediate success may not be likely, but ultimate failure is impossible. We live in a universe of infinite opportunity. We advance in the school of life according to ability and inclination, moved forward by the gentle but insistent proddings of the greatest of all teachers, the law of necessity. When we realize that we all come into this world to increase understanding through experience, problems of human relationships are simplified. Associations become important because they bring ever-increasing opportunities for understanding, tolerance, and mutual improvement. We grow and mature together through the gracious privilege of sharing. Thus we come to realize that we can be friendly beings, mutually helpful, gaining a rich and lasting enjoyment from pleasant associations, and not attempting to dominate or possess each other. The school child must adjust his mind to the concept of learning, and when he does this, his lessons become valuable experiences. If he does not adjust, he is simply miserable. It is the same in the school of life. There is nothing in nature that denies man's right to be happy while he learns. There is a real and deep satisfaction when we keep faith with the spirit of growth. It is when we break faith and deny the ever-present good that we open ourselves to misery. If we really desire contentment and peace of mind, we must keep the laws governing our destinies.
This is the end of the recording on side one. Turn the cassette over to play side two.